Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
So this evening, Les will be talking to us. Thank you, Les, in advance of your talk. And I will spotlight you. And you can, you should be set. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. In speaking about our mind, we say that there are two kinds of minds, or two kinds of worlds. And first, there is the analytical mind. Sometimes we know it as ordinary mind or small mind. And it's the mind of everyday things and everyday activities. It is the mind of the phenomenal world of objects. And of course, it is the mind that we are all familiar with. But in our practice, we say there is also Buddha mind, or sometimes called big mind. And this is the mind of the spiritual world, of the absolute. And usually the mind of the relative thinking world, the mind familiar to us, is known simply as the mind. It analyzes and labels everyday things, making our everyday life possible. And by contrast, the spiritual Buddha mind does not label and does not analyze. It simply experiences and reflects without analyzing. It perceives and feels and hears. And it is through this spiritual mind, through this Buddha mind, that provides the way of understanding daily things. The spiritual mind is the Buddhist way of understanding what's going on in daily life. And this understanding comes from undiluted observation and experience. And it does it without any kind of analytical thinking. So in the thinking mind, subject and object are separated. They're made into two so that they can relate to each other, which is so necessary for us to live our daily lives. But in the world of the absolute, subject and object are one. They are not two. And so from the standpoint of the absolute, we are Buddha. In other words, our Buddha mind includes the objective world in all of its forms, in all of its delights, and in all of its difficulties. And when we understand this point, problems are no longer separate from us. And problems are not problems anymore. So there is no need to label something called problem as a problem. Problems are our self. They are just how we take care of life. So we really cannot lose ourselves in our problems. We really cannot lose ourselves in the world of objects. When we sit, we understand this point. When we sit, we are in the midst of problems and objects. And we have big mind, and we are Buddha. In the spiritual world, the things that we see and the things that we hear have no unique meaning. In the spiritual world, they are not separate from each other, and they are not separate from us. In ordinary life, if some kind of noise occurs, we may think, oh, I hear a door slam. But when a sound comes to Buddha mind, the Buddha mind does not seek for a cause. And when that happens, we no longer feel the need to name it or recognize it as separate. So when we reflect on any problem that comes up for us, we include ourselves with the problem. And we see it through the eyes of the spiritual and absolute world. This is our practice. But our teaching tells us that the world of objects, the everyday world, the phenomenal world, is inherently spiritual. It is not a different world, a world different from spiritual world. The phenomenal world is a reflection of or an expression of what is. Of what is. And the what is of our everyday life is originally spiritual, originally unphenomenal. So we cannot touch the what is with our senses. It exists and it doesn't exist. It is the background of our daily life. The inherent nature of the spiritual world is infinite. It's all inclusive and it's constantly changing, impermanent and fleeting. And we can't grasp it because it has no handles. And yet, at the same time, it is the basis of our everyday phenomenal existence. Perhaps the most important thing we can learn from our teaching, from our practice and from our teaching, is that our daily life has no meaning if we ignore our spiritual side. If we do that, if we ignore our spiritual side, our everyday life becomes just a series of mechanically connected events, seen through our memory, seen through our emotions, and our desires. And it's because of this limited way of seeing that leads to emphasis on ourself. which results in our always trying to gain something. And this creates an unsatisfying life. And it is this sense of dissatisfaction with our life that brings us to practice. And as students of Suzuki Roshi, we will, when we come to practice, we soon hear the term gaining idea. Give up gaining idea, he says. You're always trying to gain something. So, for this practice to help us with our understanding and our sense of ourself, it is quite necessary to accept and to trust our inherent spiritual nature. And that means we have to learn to appreciate and embrace change. And this is not always easy. But through our practice, we prepare ourselves, we become more and more ready for something new in each moment. When we can let go of an attachment to the current moment and be ready for whatever comes up in the new moment, that's how we find the joy in life. Even if trouble comes to our life or pain appears unexpectedly. So our practice seems to have a kind of mystical nature because our practice asks us to see the world without relying on our eyes. Our practice says to us that this is not the usual rational way of seeing the world, but it is necessary. Because it is the only way to see the what is, the only way to see the unphenomenal, the only way to see the background. Do not rely on the eyes or the senses. So, in our practice, we develop the attitude to allow our practice to lead us, to learn to trust that we know who we are and where we are, even if it feels like we are in the midst of darkness, where there are no labels and there's no judging. There is no single event or experience that can transform us. Not from going from a child to an adult, and not from going from delusion to enlightenment. There is no single initiation ceremony in life. Of course, we do have ceremonies to mark our important life moments. And we do it to make them public and to make them consciousness, to acknowledge a new role in the relative world. such as a graduation, a marriage, or a bar mitzvah. It is, in the world of Buddhism, it is each moment of change that is an initiation. An initiation into the mystery of the spiritual world. Each initiation becomes a separation from the past, a step into the unknown, a step into changing. When we are always ready for change, then we are continually initiated. Then we can understand our life and appreciate our life. Then we can express our spiritual being and our true nature. And we understand the what is. Very often, we want and we expect a single exciting event in our life to help define us. We want it to be direct, and we want it to be recognizable, and we want this exciting event to transform us. I think some people who come to practice are looking for that exciting event to be transformed so they can say, now I am changed. Now there's no going back. And after some time, months or years, when that single exciting event doesn't happen, we may think, we're not up to it. We're not capable. We're not competent. That somehow we don't know how to practice. And maybe we think, well, maybe in the next lifetime. Or maybe we think, I keep missing these moments. And we may develop self-doubts. Why am I so incompetent that I can't have this single exciting event, or these several exciting events? And then we may feel that we need some kind of guru to show us how to have it. I think this is not uncommon. But our particular practice tells us, do not rely on a guru. If we wait for a single event to transform us, we will become disappointed. Because we haven't yet understood the nature of our spiritual life. We are not ready to accept the reality of change. And this is how we miss the true meaning of our life. It is like waiting at the side of a road for the bus. For the bus that never comes. And we think we missed it. It is how we run the risk of remaining a child indefinitely, always carrying the pain of inner longing. The special event that we may crave does not pass us by, and we do not miss it. It's just that we do not see each event of change as the initiation. Each moment of change is a ceremony. Each moment of our life is a ceremony. And with each ceremony, we participate in the mystery of the spiritual. So there is no single initiation that can raise us to some new level. Initiation is continuous. We don't need to wait to be initiated. We just have to be ready to let go of the old. And to step into the new with determination, without any guarantee of any result. This is our attitude. So our spiritual practice is a continuous initiation. We are continually unmaking and remaking ourselves. This is the expression of our true nature. Our true nature is always ready to unmake and remake itself. So our practice is a practice of initiation, where we are open to our elemental, primitive nature. Our true self emerges through the rawness of these initiations continually. It's not necessary, and it is a mistake to try to smooth it over. Let it be raw and rough. It's the nature of initiations. Whatever appears in our practice, we need to accept, whether it is clarity or whether it is confusion, whether it is comfort or discomfort. So if pain comes, we simply sit with the pain. If disappointment comes, we go ahead without pause. We have to exist in the fire of whatever appears. We have to allow ourselves to be initiated over and over again. This is our life. Thank you. And we have time for some questions, if you like. All right, see you. Any questions?
Janet.
Janet.
Unmute. Hi, Les. Sometimes I think it's a problem of the language, how we talk about spiritual and spirituality as though it's something separate from reality, when really it's just a bigger kind of reality. So, I don't know. Whenever I hear the word spiritual, it sort of ticks something in me. And I think, no, not spiritual. That's just real. It's just a bigger real, you know? So anyway, thanks for your talk. Really good to see you. Yeah, did we lose him?
Les, I think your microphone is muted.
Yeah, my Zoom crashed for a few seconds.
I'm sorry, I crashed your Zoom. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Dainuri. Oh, you better unmute. Okay.
Hi, Les.
Hi.
I was particularly interested in your talk tonight because I had the most amazing experience of getting a Zoom video of the bar mitzvah of my 13-year-old grandson, in which my son attended. And I couldn't help but think this initiation ritual as it happened in Germany. In any case, the spiritual elders were there and he spoke and recited in Hebrew. And I was deeply touched and moved and I think that the dividing line in my own personal experience, I think I went to basic training in the military, in the Air Force, and that was a raw kind of initiation. But the fundamental difference is one was a spiritual initiation in the case of the bar mitzvah, and the other was really into a secular state initiation as a warrior for the state, as it were. And I see that. Could you address that in your sensibility? I see my grandson getting a wonderful start in the spiritual was recognized so early in his life, whereas it took me much, much longer to realize how important that aspect was. And I was, you know, consumed by secularism, as it were.
So the bar mitzvah is a public recognition that this young man has reached a certain stage in life and now has new responsibilities. And it's to let him know and everybody know that he does have these responsibilities. And the ceremony is pretty serious. It's kind of elaborate. Takes a lot of preparation, and it impresses on the mind of the initiate, the 13-year-old boy, that these guys aren't fooling around. This is an important ceremony. Take it seriously. You know, I think the same thing is true in the secular world. If you go into the military and you start to do basic training and you don't know what you're doing, and some sergeant comes out and starts yelling at you, you know, stand up and don't slouch and hold your weapon upright, or whatever he may say in a very loud, threatening voice. He's trying to tell you it's serious. Don't be casual with it. So in both the everyday world and in the spiritual world, there are some very serious initiations, and we should pay attention to both of them. And, you know, it feels good to have initiations in both worlds so that we learn to take both worlds very seriously. We live our secular life with seriousness and we live our spiritual life with seriousness. Because we know that there are moments of newness. Initiated into newness, initiated into a new role, giving up the old In the military, your sergeant will tell you, give up those old habits and stand up straight. In the spiritual world, we say, let go of the past. Let go of your old biases and habits. I think this is a fundamental principle for how we humans live our lives. Go into the new and let go of the old. Oh, it's nice that you got to see the ceremony, Dainuri.
Oh, it was beautiful. And I guess the thing that deeply resonates with me now, and I do appreciate exactly what you said about basic training. The difference between a bar mitzvah and having a sergeant, you know, having them cut off your hair and yell at you, is ahimsa. I love to see a spiritual warrior rite of passage become available, rather than a secular warrior. And I think that that rite of passage, and believe me, I do appreciate that there, I'm not totally against the military. I couldn't be with my background. But I think that a recognition of, a deep recognition of the essential spiritual nature that's allied with nonviolence is really important. And it's something my grandson got, and I feel I missed.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan?
Yes, hi, Les.
Hi, Dan.
Thank you. The talk, the initiation into the moment comes to mind, and that's what I was thinking of when you spoke of it. And to me, there is something, and you talked about mysticism also in the mystical moment. And I do think that the mystical side is, you know, associated with our inability to actually get to the moment. I mean, to me, there's a wall to that moment. And I think I'd like to just understand better what you mean, initiation and the moment. Because I think that's fundamental, and I kind of get it, but when I kind of get it, I lose it.
Initiation in the moment?
Yes. And I think that's, I was hearing you talk about it from that point of view, that there's an engage, I guess I think about it as an engagement with the moment, and I was thinking initiation in the same way.
Well, usually we think of our life as a series of moments that are a continuation of our life, which they are. But at the same time, something new is happening. Something is changing. And if we see our life as a series of continuous unfolding moments, like a movie, we miss the point. Each moment is an initiation. Each moment is a new life. This is the joy of our practice. Each moment is a new life. We're not simply continuing the habits we developed over the past 10 or 20 years or 40 years. What's new? The next moment. What's new? Where am I going? Let's go. And in the next moment, the same question is lurking in the background. This, I think, is the energizing principle of our practice. What's new?
And Les, because of that, one way of looking at it would be that there seems to be no peace.
No peace?
No peace. no lack of suffering, because there's always what's new. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. And to me, that feels difficult.
Mm. Yeah, it's a fair point. We have to learn to be ready to make adjustments every moment. Every moment. So, you know, when the alarm rings in the morning and you wake up and it's so comfortable and you have to get out of bed and, you know, you want to stay there, but you move on to the next thing and you make your adjustment in what you want, and you go and you walk down the hall and you turn on the coffee, mm-hmm. or whatever you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard.
So I've been through several different initiations in my life. I'll mention briefly that I was in the Royal Rangers as a kid. It was like the Boy Scouts, but it was like a Christian group. And our motto was ready, mentally, spiritually, and physically ready. And then later, after high school, I went in the Navy. I was in boot camp is another type of initiation. And I appreciated what you were talking, I guess, Denuri. I haven't met you before. I appreciated listening to your experience. And the motto or the watchwords in boot camp were similar to be ready. Attention to detail. No skylarking. I just mentioned briefly that there's a movie about a bar mitzvah, a Jewish family called A Serious Man. It's a Coen Brothers film, if you care to watch it. I guess my question for you, Les, is how we can bring and like rituals into our daily life. Is it always necessary and helpful to like, does it need to be formal, or can it just be just in our day-to-day life? If you have lots to share about that. Thank you.
You know, everything we should do should be a ritual. Doesn't have to be formal. They don't have to be formal, but they have to be mindful. So if I pick up this pen to write something, you know, if I do it mindfully, it's more satisfying this than just making a casual grab for it. And then when I write, to put my mind to it and not be casual or sloppy about it, to do it in the right way. And then there are moments when we do want to make it formal. If you have an altar at home, and you want to greet the day with offering a stick of incense, you do it mindfully, and that's kind of formal. So if we can try to make each thing we do and each conversation that we have a small ceremony or a small ritual, we find that life is becomes very, very satisfying. And that seems to be a secret, which doesn't have to be a secret, which shouldn't be a secret. For us, it's not a secret. We know that. We know that when we finish a cup of tea, we mindfully wash the cup and dry the cup and mindfully put it away rather than leaving dirty dishes in the sink for whoever may come along to clean it. There's a lot of satisfaction and joy in knowing I completed this. It's not formal, but it's mindful. And it lets us complete the actions of our life. Part of the problem of following that kind of thinking is the speediness of our everyday life. We have the feeling that we're not permitted to slow down enough to have everything be mindful. We're being told, stop being mindful and get on with it. Be speedy. That's a problem. But that's discussion for another time, maybe even for a workshop or something. It's a good question, Richard. Thank you.
Good evening, Les.
Hi, David.
Good to see you and hear you again. You spoke of being serious about transitions in the spiritual world and in the regular world. And the regular world down here where I live, the Buddhist community is very noisy with social justice issues. Lots of leaders saying, join me in this, you should be doing that. And there seems to be just so many possible initiations, so many possible engagements with this and that and the other, that I at least find myself picking one out of 20 or so, and that raises the problem of saying no to everything else. I have a great deal of problem genuinely engaging whatever movement that I wouldn't normally do. I can't change myself to do that sincerely, but I also have lots of problems saying no to so many things. How can we when it's raining opportunities, raining challenges?
I think it's a matter of, for each of us, recognizing our limits, what resources we have personally, what time we have available to us, and honestly admitting, I only have resources to do this much, and no need to feel bad that we couldn't do everything else. We're limited. Every creature has a limitation, has limitations, and we humans have our limitations too. Some of us can do more, have the capacity to do more than others. And some of us need to focus on just maybe one or two things. So it's okay, it's important actually to recognize our limits and to learn to live with them. It's not necessary to be concerned that our limits aren't larger than they actually are, but to apply ourselves within our limits. That's the main thing. Whatever it is you choose to do out of the 20 or 40 that are available to you, choose one and jump in and do it to the best of your ability and trust that others will take care of those other opportunities. I know the feeling. I think we all do. I think we're all getting these days being reminded through emails that there are so many opportunities to do good works. And, you know, mark it as read and move on to the next one. But once in a while, one will come along to say, ah, that's one I can relate to. Don't worry about the others. Thank you.
Nicholas has his hand up.
Hey, Les, thank you for your talk.
Hi, Nicholas.
So Dan raised the point, sorry, Dan, I don't mean to call you out. Dan raised the point that because the only constant is change, there's this perceived lack of peace or this feeling of peace. But I have to say, in my experience, because there is nothing but change, that's actually been incredibly freeing for me. And I've actually found that, you know, because it's almost as if we're constantly being reborn moment to moment, that I've actually been able to go back to times in the past and realize, you know, oh, I didn't know as well back then. And I'm sorry, I apologize. Or I realize, you know, I didn't have that experience just yet, but I have it now. And that was a really powerful teaching moment. So Les, I'm wondering if you can say something about the fact that we're constantly being initiated into something new, that that's actually very freeing.
It's the nature of life. But usually we don't recognize it. I think our emphasis as individuals in this society is to, you know, plan ahead, make progress, achieve objectives, adjust your plan if the objective is escaping. And that's the way societies run. But if we feel dissatisfied, if we feel there's something lacking, in simply following along what society tells us to do, then we start exploring what's missing. And that's how we find our way to practice. Then at first we wonder what's my trade-off? But after a while, we realize there is no trade-off. The things that we need to do to help our own lives and to help the life of our society is no different than expressing our spiritual nature. This is the gift of our practice, this recognition. I don't have to make two worlds. It's all one. Thank you.
Thank you, Laz.
Teresa.
Not Teresa.
Hi, Les.
Hi, Teresa.
Thank you for your talk. You use so many powerful words and images. And that image of the waiting on the side of the road for the bus made me a little bit sad. But you also said that we have the risk of remaining a child indefinitely and always carrying the pain of inner longing. So I wanted to ask you about that. What does it mean to be an adult, and what is this inner longing?
That's very profound. When we feel separate or separated, we long to be joined. Sometimes it's longing to be rejoined with our family, but quite often it's about being rejoined with our true self, to reconnecting with our true self, because a connection has been broken somehow. And so in a way we practice to reconnect, to fulfill that longing, the need to come home. You know, there's a tradition in Zen practice of leaving home. But it's the leaving home. The leaving home is the journey for returning home. So, in a strange way, you know, we leave home in order to return home, or in order to return to our true self. This inner longing is about us wanting to know who we are fundamentally. Who we are beyond the labels of everyday life, but who am I fundamentally? And this is the nature of spiritual seeking. Thank you.
Columbine.
Hey, Les.
Oh, there you are. Hi, Columbine.
Hi. You know, it's funny that Teresa just asked that question, because that was kind of along the lines of what my question was as well. I guess I thought if I was taking you too literally with the child thing, because I thought it almost seemed like you were implying that once you were an adult, you kind of stopped yearning for this, you know, grand thing to happen. And I was also thinking about my own struggle, like fear of becoming an adult, because when you're a child, you have a parent who takes care of you. And you can society kind of lets you make mistakes. And I think it can be scary to become an adult, because then you have these responsibilities and then maybe you lose your parents. And so it felt like that was, and then I also was thinking about, you know, children And I don't really associate children with like an inherent yearning. You know, a child seems kind of actually more in touch with who they are. And so I wonder if what, like what you just said about feeling lost, it seems like more of like a midlife thing than a, that a child seems sort of happy-go-lucky. But I don't quite know what my question is, but it's hard for me. It seemed like what you were saying was that being a child and waiting for something good to happen was bad, and becoming an adult was finally like a maturation. Whereas in my own life, it's like being a child is easier, and becoming an adult is scary.
Being a child means to be spontaneous, to feel free to pick up one toy after the other and not to worry about a thing. So there's no longing then. Everything is right there. Everything is something to play with, to learn from, to experience. But like you say, as we get older, some of that spontaneity seems to be taken away from us. As adults, we can no longer do things just as we please. We do have these responsibilities. The problem is when we become adults and we long for the freedom of childhood, that's when we can have a problem. I think it's important that we come to the feeling that the things that we do in our adult life can feel just as spontaneous and joyful as the things we did as children. We can have a good time with the responsibilities of our adult life. New experiences, new things to play with, new worlds to open. Of course, as we know, the only problem is there's some external forces that make demands on us, and we have to reconcile with that. But you know, once we tell ourselves, I do have responsibilities in my adult life, but I don't have to be a slave to them. I don't have to be a mental and emotional slave to them. I can treat them as things to explore and things to learn from. And ways to become wiser. And we can learn how to do that. Thank you.
Travis.
Les, thanks for your talk tonight. I was wondering if you could say something about how we should consider heroes. You know, in this conversation, we've talked about what it means to be an adult. And in some sense, to grow older, I think, is to recognize and start to live within your limits. And, you know, that mindfulness that we carry with us to come back to the unphenomenal. You know, it's, I always think of it like the Brothers Grimm story of like having the breadcrumbs, you know, I don't get too far away from what's essential. But, you know, I think to be young and to be idealistic and to see a need or a cause and to devote yourself to it, and even to risk yourself or to, in a sense, sacrifice for the good, it kind of goes beyond the intrapersonal part of our lives that we devote ourselves to practice to become grounded, I think, and stable. But how are we to, I wonder if you have any ideas about, you know, those that really, you know, venture and for the greater good. And how should we, yes, how should we consider those people?
Well, I think it was yesterday, there was a passing of somebody who is considered to be a hero in the human rights area, the racial equality area. You know, Vernon Jordan is his name, and I think he died yesterday. He was a great civil rights activist, and he dedicated his life to creating good. To trying to create good. And many people are expressing their admiration for his efforts and what he did, what he tried to do. So I think the first thing we can do when we come across or hear about people like that, so-called heroes who gave an extra measure of themselves, the first thing we should do is admire what they did and learn from what they did. And see, maybe it's possible that there's a little bit of that in us. Maybe we can be inspired by what they did. Through our admiration of them, we can be inspired by what they did. And I think it's okay to identify people who made sacrifices. It's okay to identify them as heroes. To remind us that there is a hero in all of us. We are all capable of doing things for the common good that maybe require some sacrifice on our part. And maybe those efforts won't get noticed, but we don't care. And when we discover that we are doing that, when we are devoting part of our lives to something that doesn't necessarily benefit us personally, but that it may benefit others, when we notice we're doing that, it's okay to admire ourselves for a moment, say, oh, look, I'm so glad that I have this capacity. That I'm doing this. I don't mean we should dwell on it and try to get it published, but it's okay to acknowledge in ourselves that we do have the capacity to do these things. And that it's always good to admire others who express this quality. So in a way, we all have the capacity to be heroes for each other, unrecognized heroes, or maybe being recognized is part of being a hero, But we make those efforts and those sacrifices for the benefit of others. And maybe others don't recognize that it's a kind of heroic thing we did, but we may see it and we may say to ourselves, it's okay. I'm glad I have a chance to do this. I'm glad I have the capacity to do this. Thank you. Do we have time? We have time for one more, at least, if you like. Okay, if not, thank you very much for your very kind attention.
I think Giuseppe had a question for you, Lad.
Oh, I didn't see it. Okay, Giuseppe.
Oh, but we can also go on. I was just curious, what is on the scroll that you have in the back there? There's something on the scroll.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the things that Suzuki Roshi gave to me at my ordination in a tradition in Japan these days. When someone is ordained, they get an awful lot of gifts from their teacher. So some of them are on the wall here. I'll have to go and look at it and look at the translation. I'll send you the translation. I can't tell you right now, but I'll look at it again and I'll send you what it says.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing.
I'll send it to you. I'll make a note. Translation to Giuseppe. Okay, I'll do that.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.